This is the PubRight Podcast, a service of the Arbortex community.
This is the PubRight Podcast, and today I have Suzanne Napoleon. Now, Suzanne is a longtime Arbortex community member and the FOSSI expert we all go to first. Suzanne, welcome.
Thank you, Liz.
So I remember back when I was learning FOSSI, I looked at your site, tutorials, whatever you had. It was, God, almost 10 years ago, I think.
Well, I've been doing this since the early 90s, working with FOSSI.
How'd you get started?
I've worked with print publishing, text processing for pretty much all of my career, with a little bit of work with data, enough to know the difference between data processing and text processing. I started out at Arbortex in technical support, but after a few months moved into consulting. And actually, there is a funny story about that. Jerry Fisher, one of the sales application engineers at the time, told me that I was the third person that Arbortex had put up against FOSSI. He was the first one, and he described it as being put in a catapult that Arbortex then released and threw him up against the rock that was FOSSI, and it didn't break. And then they tried somebody else, and that didn't work out, and I was the third one, so he wished me good luck.
Wow.
I came to think of the FOSSI as a something like I was in a prize fight with another boxer, and sometimes that boxer did not play fair. The standard said it was supposed to do one thing, but it didn't really. But and at times I felt like a punch-drunk fighter who ought to get out of the rink, but in the end I think I licked the FOSSI. I think
that's
I won that
now. That's a
great
way to describe it. I think that's how we all feel when we get started, but it's nice to know that eventually, hopefully, we can get out of it.
Well, I had the advantage of being in-house and could bug report everything I needed to and, you know, get direct information from John Lloyd and Andrew Dobrowski, and I guess I could mention Joan Chen in there and others. It makes all the difference. I think about a third of the bugs that I reported were erroneous on my part. A third of them got fixed, and a third of them came up with workarounds. So I don't know if that's the greatest stats, but it made all the difference in terms of my learning, you know, the formatting engine kind of almost from the inside out.
So I think that's pretty common that we have a good portion of the bugs. It's amazing that yours is as low as a third. A good portion of the bugs we usually submit are, we don't realize that we're the ones who did it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, when I reviewed my summaries, the summary lines from some of those, they were indistinguishable. The false reports were indistinguishable from the ones that turned out to be a bug. You know what I mean? The wording was,
yeah.
You know, there was
yeah.
No way to know. So those are my stats. What can I do about it?
That's pretty good. So what's your favorite example of when it didn't play fair?
Oh, golly. I can't think. It's too long ago, and I think we were still at version A of the Outspec DTD, so it probably wouldn't even apply at this point. But
so does it always play fair now?
It's a lot better. It's a lot better, I have to say. But it's a declarative language, so you know, the only thing that works is what is known to work. I mean, what somebody's done. There's plenty of stuff that you could code that, you know, nothing will happen because nothing's hooked up underneath, which
right.
is why I encourage everybody to bug report everything. Even if there's a workaround, report it, get it on the record, and get the functionality into the product. And the more people who, you know, vote for a bug fix, the more likely it is to happen. Actually, most likely is the easy one. The easy ones get fixed first, at least when I was there. But
right.
enough demand, you know, can help make it happen. So,
right.
You know, there So you can have expectations, but, you know, just encode anything you want, but it might not be hooked up and nothing will happen, so, even though it would appear that it should.
Right.
So, there's plenty of stuff that could be done. It just needs to be prioritized.
Right. And the PTC has been really pushing for customer feedback in that way. So I also encourage people to submit and vote on their bugs because that's the only way they get answered, at least now.
Yeah, you know, with the declarative language, you know, and all the combinations and permutations of alphabets and languages and applications, you know, they can't possibly test everything. You know what I mean? It's an impossible job. So feedback from users is critical, you know, to keeping quality in the product,
absolutely.
In my humble opinion.
Oh, it's completely true. Work is never finished, and until they run into that, let's see, Doug Wade has a way of putting it. He says, I didn't have the imagination to figure this was going to be a problem.
Yes, yeah.
Right? And you can't always know.
Well, I know that it soon became, doing FOSSI consulting and with the FOSSI team, soon became clear that the best approach was to tackle the unknowns first, because you didn't really know if it was going to work, and save the known stuff for last, so that if you had to report a bug, there was some chance it would be the fix would be in the next release. You know, if you waited and left that stuff to the end, you had an open-ended project. So it was best to tackle that stuff early on and get any, you know, bug reports filed that you needed to, and hopefully by the time of delivery you had a fix. So you would save the known quantities for last, but every once in a while what you thought was a known quantity turned out to not work because the circumstances were just a tiny little bit different. So, you know, it's not a foolproof approach, but it certainly is what I strongly urge people to do. Even though you want to do the easy stuff first, save the hard stuff for last, but in terms of how, you know, a successful project and, you know, looking good and looking okay at the end of it, it's better to do the tough stuff first. Again, in my humble
opinion.
That's true.
No, I agree with you. It's always, because that's the part you're not sure whether, how long it's going to take or whether it's going to get fixed or whether it's an issue.
Yeah.
And the earlier you know, the better.
Exactly. If you do the hard stuff first, then you can easily estimate the known quantities. If you do it the other way around, you don't know how long it's going to take, and somebody's always asking. So.
Somebody always is. That's true. So
usually more than one person.
Exactly. There you go. So you've been doing this a long time. Tell me a couple of your most interesting stories. All right, customer, fascinating data, hard project.
Well, the most demanding customer was Caterpillar. They dotted every I and crossed every T. They were fairly early on. So that really got us all kind of on our toes for future customers.
What was particularly different? Like, what kind of things were they tough on?
Everything. Every item on the there was never. They could never end a call early and just skip that last issue on the list. And just take our word for it. Well, that's fixed. We had to discuss it in detail and prove it. They were very, very demanding.
Exacting,
that's the word I want. Yes. I guess the first FOSSI that I worked on was Paramax, and that's when I took over for somebody else, and that's when I realized that, I guess Paul Klock was the one who defined it as the all permutations FOSSI versus the conventional use support. That particular DTD allowed footnotes and everything, and everything in footnotes, you know, including tables and graphics, and vice versa. And you know, it was, early on, so we really didn't have a requirements, anything like that, in terms of identifying requirements and specs, implementation stuff. So, so that was the first step. Then. In learning how, you know, the consulting process, what the consulting process for FOSSI development needed to be. Then I got involved with the Freightliner Fosse's, and that was four different publications from one DTD. And that's when I learned that sample documents were not enough for testing, because they provided all the test docs, all the sample docs that we wanted. But it turned out to be not sufficient for testing the DTD and the Fosse. So that's when I learned about developing test docs and started writing that up. So each customer, you know, each client was, you know, learned something. And, you know, after a few of them, the need for what the consulting process needed to be, the groundwork was really established at that point. We fine-tuned it over time and came up with the forms and whatnot. But understanding those basics really helps a lot.
So you mentioned forms. What do you mean by that?
Well, we put together requirements forms for collecting requirements and information, and also for collecting the actual specs. We divided them into two separate processes. If you don't get the work, if you don't get the project, there's no point in going into the details of the specs. Requirements are what you do to get to do an estimate. You know, it doesn't matter whether it's 9-point type or 10-point type for the estimate. You save those details for, you know, after you've got the purchase order. So that was another thing. You know, you learn by experience. Nobody had ever done this kind of thing before, so we made it up as we went along. But it got to be where it worked out pretty well. We had a bunch of, you know, Fosse consultants, and we, you know, pooled our knowledge and made it all work pretty smoothly. Because we were the only ones in the world doing it, we were a pretty close team.
Right.
You know, there's no book, there's, you know, nothing to go by but our own experience and our own help to each other. And so we were a pretty tight team. It was very enjoyable working like that.
That's great. Do you still have those people on your team now, or that you work together once in a while?
No, not at this point. Everybody's pretty much dispersed around in different groups. I guess Jerry Tippy is still at PTC.
Yes.
But other than that, I've all kind of gone our separate ways.
Interesting.
So.
And you developed the tutorials and a book now. When did those get started?
Well, actually, I had developed tutorials, workshops for when I was at Arbortext, when the Adept 8.0 release came out. I had divided up the training into a screen Fosse training, and then part two was
the print
Fosse training. But at that time, the people coming to class were not necessarily IT developers. They were people working with FrameMaker, you know, Word, that kind of thing. They were publishing folks. All these IT developers that came out, you know, with the web, you know, just weren't there then. So it was the courses were not very technical. They taught you how to use the interfaces and the basics. They were available as self-paced workshops as well. But then I realized that I could improve on what I had done, you know, 10 years earlier, whatever it was, and developed the new tutorials, because I'd seen too many people try to learn it on their own, trial and error, and they just, you know, didn't get it. Whereas if you can experience the basics, you know, and get the concepts down, it's not that hard. I mean, it's not like XSL or anything, or DISL, you know.
Close enough, but yeah.
It's just not, it doesn't have to be that hard. And if you follow, you know, the standard conventions, the best practices, you don't even need a whole lot of understanding, because they're kind of geared to just work without necessarily knowing all the, you know, dirty details.
Wow, I took those two classes.
I'm sorry, say that again.
I took those two classes at Arbortext.
Yes, how about that? Well,
I didn't know you wrote them.
Oh, yeah.
That's fascinating.
Well, when 7.0, I think it was either 6.0 or 7.0 came out, it was just a screen. It was just an edit window. There was no publishing with it. It was just for authoring. And at that point, people were asking for, there had been a training course being taught, but it was pretty much geared for print. And when I think it was 6.0 came out, then people were asking for a strictly screen FOSSI training. So that's when I thought, well, let's, you know, do this in two parts so that people can get what they want. And with the 8.0 release coming out, then I geared it for that, which was the new support for the, you know, kind of the latest version of the app spec. So it made sense to do it for that release.
Interesting. Wow, that's very cool. So, and so since then, you've got tutorials that you've written.
Yeah.
On your site.
Yeah, I had, you know, there's a lot more information at that point because after 8.0 was released, it opened up, there was a lot more support for stuff that was in the out spec, in the standard. A lot more that could be done that just wasn't available in the previous releases. So, so over the years, you know, I gained a lot more knowledge and thought, well, we'll just put this in the tutorials and kind of hit on all the stuff that's not even just strictly FOSSI, but is part of Arbortext support. User-defined tags, you know, namespace, change tracking, and, you know, page layout tags, and, you know, FOSSI PIs, all that kind of little stuff that is not strictly FOSSI, but you can still format with Arbortext editor. So all of that is in the new tutorials. Just to give people an idea that just because it's not in the DTD, there may still be ways you can do it, kind of thing.
Nice. That's always good to know.
Yeah.
That's the thing that launches you into being really good at what you do.
And I also included lots and lots of tips and tricks in the tutorials and also in the book based on my experience. You know, like code color on a region, background color on a region so you can see where it is, you know, when you're coding it and then remove
right.
it. That's, you know, those sorts of kinds of things or, you know,
nice.
Best practices and whatnot. So people don't all have to learn the long, hard way, kind of, you know, cut to the chase, hit the ground running.
Tell us about the book.
Oh, the book. I know too much about the subject. That's my problem. Preview page count with front, back cover, and index is over 700 pages at this point. It's
wow. My God.
Killing me. I've been posting some stuff on the on my website and get ready to post some more, and I'm going to be asking for people to review manuscript, the PDF manuscript, at some point when I'm going to be off on something else. It seemed like a good time to ask for some help on this.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of code. I've included so many examples. I didn't really want to write anything unless I tested it myself to prove that it worked. And once I tested it, I thought, well, I might as well just put the example in there. And then once I'd finalized that, I realized, well, gee, if I made this one little change, it would be so much better example that you could, you know, use for blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And so then I had to revisit it, so it's just taking forever. But I really want people to be able to steal this code, you know.
Nice.
All this having to make it, everybody having to, you know, figure it out for themselves, that just doesn't make sense to me. When you're a student, well, yeah, you got to do that. But when you're working for a living, what's the point?
Yeah.
I don't get it. Let's just get the job done.
Exactly. Well, and that's part of why we started these podcasts and other things and why we do the Adapters Archive, because, you know, that's how we all, that's, well, not how you learned. You learned via being thrown against a rock, but
yeah.
I learned at the feet of somebody else.
Uh-huh.
Right? And so much of that is locked into all of our tribal knowledge heads, and it really needs to be elsewhere.
Yes, yes. The Adapters Archives are great, and I'm trying to, you know, just be another resource like that with the book. And actually, I would say that I want the book to be a companion to the tutorials, because the book does not cover how to use the interfaces. It just really wasn't any way to get that in there. But that's what the tutorials really focus on, is, you know, getting the most out of the interfaces. There's a whole lot that you can do with one or both, and together they really can get the job done. The Resolve
Excellent.
Feature in the style panels interface is precious beyond gold, especially if you're working on a fossey developed by somebody else. There's just no substitute for this, the trace that tells you exactly where something was coded, rather than going through the long, hard process of, you know, tracking it down through, you know, spaghetti code. So, and the other thing about the tutorials is they have a lot of working code, you know, files, working fosseys that people can, you know, cannibalize, borrow, whatever, scavenge from, you know, stuff that really works. For most of the, you know, the common stuff that you do with Fosse. And that stuff just isn't out there anymore. PTC has been trying to push Styler. Well, for a while they were trying to push the XSL, but, you know, now it's the Styler. So there really isn't a whole lot of, you know, good Fosse files out there to you know, use. So that's the other thing.
That's true.
And actually, I use those. I have to admit, I use those some of those files to do my own testing, you know, on something related. Because I already know I have all this, you know, stuff in place. I just go in and make a few changes there and see what happens. And it's a nice, real quick, easy way, you know, to test stuff rather than trying to set it up in what you're working on. You know, just go over and put in a few lines of code, and there you are. It's you know what you need to know. So, I have been told that the tutorials are an ongoing resource. You know, you can learn, you can go back, you can, you know, reuse the files, you know, borrow from them in the future. So they're priced at a fraction of what the Arbortext workshops cost, but they're meaty. I guarantee they're meaty.
Oh, absolutely. I know that Clay Helberg swears by them.
Oh, good. Good to hear.
Whenever anybody asks a question, he's like, oh, you've seen these, right? And I think we all point to you as on a regular basis.
Excellent. Thank you. Glad to hear it.
Oh, yeah, glad to. You know, that's how it works. And you're the best resource for someone getting ready and learning how to do it, and even developing their skills farther once they know the basics.
Yeah, I've looked into, you know, XSL, done some XSL work and whatnot, but Fosse is so fast in Arbortext Editor that, and it can do so much more than everything else except the 3B2 stuff, which I really have not gotten into, but the speed of it. And what you can do with it, especially for the edit window, I'm really trying to promote. I'm really trying to promote Fosse because I don't think people realize, you know, all the great things it can do for you in Arbortext Editor.
Yeah, I remember, God, it had to be three or four or five more than that years ago. Ed Benton and Clay did an XSL FO versus Fosse standoff presentation.
Oh, I remember there was talk about that. Yeah, but I never.
And it was great. Yeah, it should have been you and Clay actually, but they discovered there was nothing you couldn't do in one that you couldn't do in the other if you knew how to do what you were doing.
Yeah, if you add ACL to Fosse, the sky's pretty much the limit. ACL, because ACL can call anything else. You know, pretty much anything else. And the sky's pretty much the limit at that point.
Excellent.
The Fosse is, I've always thought of it as kind of the, well, not exactly bottleneck, but that's why I've tried to really stay focused on Fosse and not get off into anything else, because if you think of it, what you can do with other scripting, well, you can do all sorts of stuff, but if you can't get it out of the Fosse, you wasted your time, you know, with all this, you know, programmatic stuff. So I try to think, okay, what can the Fosse do? What can, you know, and then work backwards from there. I don't know if that makes sense. But, you know, if the Fosse can't do it, it doesn't matter what can be done with other scripting. So it's really, you need to focus on what's the output. And then think, okay, well, now if Fosse can output that, how do I get it to that point? So, but you can't think programmatically. If you think programmatically, you know, FOSI is not programmatic. It's not procedural. So if you start thinking in those terms, you know, it doesn't work. You need to think along the FOSI frame of mind. And once you've got that established, then you can back up and, you know, think the, you know, how you get what it is, all the information together to give to the FOSI. That's more the easy part. The hard part is figuring out, you know, how to get it out of the FOSI.
Right. So that sort of leads me to one of the questions I was going to ask you. What's the hardest thing when you're getting started? You're right that most people come from FrameMaker. They're not programmers. They're not IT folks. What's the first thing that's hard for them to get their head around to get started?
Well, for some people, the fact that it isn't procedural. People coming from more, you know, a programming background expect it to be procedural. That's what I expected when I first started, and it's not. The inheritance and the defaulting stuff well, the way I do it in the tutorials, try to show people in a simple way how it works. If you don't experience that, if you try to read it and figure it out, it all seems maybe a little overly complicated. Once people get past that and get to the char subsets, the style sets, then there's a, you know, that's pretty comfortable because most people are used to some kind of a formatting macro. But okay. I think the inheritance of defaulting and that sort of thing is unusual, you know. You don't
right.
typically experience that, you know, with FrameMaker or whatever. The idea of an inherited formatting, that kind of, you know, you know, understood. But, you know, the fact that some stuff defaults and some stuff inherits, that kind of clouds the issue for folks. But once you get past that and get to char subsets and show how you can really do that, then it's not so bad. That comes pretty easily, I think, to folks then. Then the next hurdle would be working with the safe text and use text and the fancy footwork, you know, that you can do with that.
Yeah, that's one of those that seems easy but turns out to be hard to get around sometimes.
Yeah, if you start with simple gen text and you're comfortable with that, and then you have, you know, a nice, easy introduction to, you know, getting fancy with that kind of stuff, I think it's, you know, not an insurmountable hurdle. But when people get thrown into it and you know, don't have that experience to build on, then they may not be able to figure it out, you know, the ways of using saves and use text before and after and, you know, getting ACL involved and whatnot. That is a new level.
I would say that adding ACL is probably an advanced topic.
You really want to know what you're doing before you get to that point. Particularly because I've noticed that in some FOSIs, people sometimes resort to ACL when they didn't really need to, when there's a FOSI way to do it. And the reason to do stuff in FOSI, if you can, is because it's compiled and it runs, you know,
right.
as a compiled language rather than, well, you know, like XSL, which is a runtime language. Mm-hmm. But if you have calls to ACL during the formatting process, that's going to slow it down. So for purposes of speed, it's best to leave ACL out if you can. On the other hand, if you have too many attribute rules, you know, spec vals, tests, that can slow it down too. So sometimes ACL could be the better way to go, but you don't want to overuse it because that can slow you down. But when you need it, it can be fantastic, just fantastic, the things that you can do. So at that point, you probably do need some procedural programmatic thinking. But, I don't think I'm telling any tales here. Peg Hellier, Trudy Billmeyer, Jerry Tippy, you know, none of them have a degree in computer science. They are all liberal arts majors. Peg's degree was in French. Jerry's is in German. So, you know, you don't need to be a rocket scientist to be, you know, a great FOSSI developer. You really can come from a text background working with text, typesetting, you know, desktop publishing, and, you know, be the tops.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I it's funny. We did a poll at the conference this last year, and almost nobody has a computer science background. I do, but most everybody else who's really good at ArborText and been doing it for 10 or 15 years or even 5, most of them came from liberal arts. It's really interesting.
How about that?
Yeah.
Well, I think that's good because computer science focuses on processing data. And text and data are as different as night and day.
Absolutely.
Data fits into nice, predefined fields of a known type and given length, and text never does. You know,
that's true.
They're just so opposite. What looks like XP could actually be Cairo in Greek or Xair in Russian.
Right.
But it's two letters, you know. There's so many subtleties to text, unknowns to text. Is that title going to be one line or three lines? Just, you know, stuff like that. If you don't have an appreciation for text, it can be very difficult to format it. Because you code something expecting, oh, well, this sample has one line heading and title. Well, I can just assume that it's always going to be one line and it will always fit in the header. Well, you're going to find out the hard way. No. Sometimes it doesn't, and you're going to be an overset, and you're going to be working on another.
Uh-oh. I think you dropped.
Hello.
Hello. It looks like my connection went down for a second there.
Yeah. All of a sudden, I could tell you weren't there anymore.
Yeah.
I don't even remember what I was talking about.
I don't either. I hope I could play it back. We were talking about, let's see if it'll play back. Oh, look at that. It goes all the way to the end. I stand by, the computers can't make it worse. Appreciation for text, good, because I actually wanted to ask you about that. There
okay.
we go. All right, so let's wrap that. Push that to the beginning, and we're still recording. Okay, good. Yes, because earlier you said it's that there's a difference between text processing and data processing. And when you're talking about, you know, computer science people versus text people, I think that you've got more to say on this.
At one point, that reminded me, at one point at ArborText, I noticed a lot of people were talking about data. You know, customer data. And I kept thinking, well, you know, it's not data. It's text. And to me, that was like saying blue when you meant red. And it seemed to me that that really wasn't helpful. But fortunately, somebody came up with the term content, which I can live with, because it doesn't imply that it's data. Because if you say data, you think fixed like fields of known type.
Right, I agree with that.
And it just doesn't work. So content, I think, works a lot better. And I don't know who thought that up, but I was happy about that.
Yeah, I know the 3B2 guys call them content streams. They just call them streams because you're not necessarily, you don't, you're dealing with stuff coming in that you don't necessarily know what it is, or it's not data.
You don't know what it is, but to call it data, I think, is misleading and gets people thinking along the wrong lines. Better to call it text and all that that implies. I frankly think that data processing is just, processing data is simpler, easier than processing text. That's why data processing is so highly automated right now, and text processing isn't so highly automated. There are still rooms full of people sitting around in front of computer screens deciding page breaks and documents with thousands of pages to them. You know, it was 50 years ago when there were rooms full of men in shirt sleeves with calculators on their desks, you know, doing manual data processing. And that's where text processing is kind of at now. That's because text is difficult to process automatically. It's just so many unknowns with it, that it just doesn't, it's taken longer to, you know, and it's still not completely, you know, automated, even with structured markup. But as someone else I worked with once remarked, well, this is back in the HTML days, you know, it makes it, HTML and XML makes text more like data, which makes it easier to process. And I think that's a good way of thinking about it. And it's a step in the right direction.
That I will agree with. 100%.
When I think
there's some things that are just easier.
Yes. When I think of, you know, all the, well, and a lot of the women, but, you know, men as well, you know, sitting in these, paging these documents manually.
I know. Yeah.
Well, I guess you could, I would say that it's always been like that with text processing, right from the beginning, you know, with hand-copied manuscripts, you know, on vellum or whatever, and the monks, and there had to be a better way, and they came up with, and Gutenberg commercialized, you know, metal type, and then for 500 years, men setting metal types thought, there's got to be a better way than picking up these letters, these tiny little letters with my fingers and putting them, and the letters are backwards. I mean, they're reverse, and you put them in the composing stick upside down.
Yeah.
You know, think how many people over the, you know, 500 years thought, geez, there's got to be a better way. And I know that, you know, in the 1800s, I forget, hundreds if not thousands of patents were filed by people who were trying to invent what, you know, the monotype and the linotype actually succeeded. Those are the two that really succeeded out of all of those attempts. Mark Twain went broke trying to bring to market an automated, you know, casting, typecasting machine, because he had early experience in a print shop. And never forgot it. Never forgot how, you know, the ordeal of handset type. So then after that, then the pace of progress and new inventions, you know, stepped up since then. Linotype and monotype were about the turn of the century, around 1900s. And then, you know, ever since that, there's been a lot of changes. You know, paper tape and was even used for feeding with a linotype or a monotype. And then into the other media and... well, yeah, I've actually been working with publishing software even before the PC was invented, back when there was dedicated hardware. So I've seen a lot of change in all the decades. But since then, up till now, but you know, structured markup to me is a vast improvement over what's come before, and what it really needs is an interface to bring it to the mainstream.
I think they're trying. Not a simple problem, though.
The problem is they're trying to make it WYSIWYG, and it's not WYSIWYG, and it shouldn't be WYSIWYG. WYSIWYG is my motto is last century technology. It's based on the typewriter. When was the last time anybody saw a typewriter? Who wants to use a typewriter? If it's WYSIWYG, it means that everything you want to do has to be hidden, or else you have to show it, or you have to find it.
Right.
The more features that are added, the more difficult it becomes to use. We need to move beyond WYSIWYG, in my humble opinion. I started working on my Easy interface.
I don't know about this.
I was using Arbitext Editor to work on a business plan, and it was an ordeal to use. I couldn't believe how, after 6 hours, everything I wanted to do, I had to do something else first. You can't read in the edit window unless you turn tags off, but you can't do much with tags off, so you have to turn them back on. You can do the same, you can read in the, edit in the doc map, but then you got to move back and forth. Or you can read in preview, and then you got to go back to the edit window. I was so tired. It was like every step I wanted to take, there was a hurdle I had to go over first. I was just, I couldn't believe that. I felt so sorry for the people out there who had to use the product. I still do, actually. it just seemed to me there had to be a better way. And I was thinking about it, and I was thinking about taking some time off from my business plan to work on it when I talked to P.G. Bartlett, who said that they were looking for a kinder, gentler, structured editing experience. So I thought, okay, I'm going to go for this because it'll help me too. And I put my ideas together, but unfortunately when I had something to demo, Arbitext backed out. P.G. actually was no longer even involved. So I've been using myself ever since, and I am. It takes the pain out, I have to tell you. And I have talked to other consulting groups and even had, there was one client project that's now on hold and another possibility. So I am still looking for a consulting organization to develop the Easy interface for a client or as just a general, what do I want to say, project, a product. As an add-on for Arbitext Editor, because I think it will change. It just makes it a lot. Well, you can use the product. You can use with the Easy interface and what I call the practical tags option. You can really configure Arbitext Editor so you don't necessarily. You can start using it without knowing anything about XML or HTML. You only have to learn how to use the product. And if you want to learn, the gory details, you can, but you don't really have to. You just have to learn how to use the interface. And I think that will make the difference. And it can be customized. That's the other nice thing. Of course, the downside is that it's always going to be DTD specific. As with anything in structured markup, it does. There is a certain amount of configuration for the DTD. There could be a kind of a turbo styler tool or something like that developed to, take the pain out of that configuration. So there's a lot of ways to, approach this, which I've discussed with other organizations, just have not brought that to fruition yet. But, as I say, I'm still looking for a partner on that.
Interesting.
But I should also mention that the business plan that I was working on was for another Arbitext editor application that dreamed up that I'm also looking for some partnering on. I do have a patent application on it.
Nice.
Do I want to call it a word processor? It's a word processor for students. The documents that students write are highly structured, whether it's a haiku or a limerick or a sonnet or a short story or a research paper, a dissertation. All of that stuff is highly structured, has specific rules about how it's supposed to be, doesn't require a database. they're just... And students don't know what the rules are. That's part of what they're learning. the idea is to have doc types just for those types of documents. And I developed actually Norma Hawkinstad got me started thinking in the direction. The interface is a kind of a cross, it's like a computer game. It takes a cockpit approach to, rather than menus, it's a cockpit. You can check that out at, the website is toocoolforschool.biz. That's a 2 and a 4. Numeral 2, cool,
right.
4, school.biz. You can see what that's all about.
Cool.
The idea is to use other scripting to count the syllables in the haiku and, you know, highlight where, there's too many syllables in the line. If you get it right, it, would play some applause or, whatever, pop something up. Do a dance. That's on the low end. On the high end, I have in mind what I call the bibliography magician, which would be where you could type in the ISBN or ISSN number of your book or serial. It would connect to an online database that would pick up the bibliographic data, send it back, product books, puts it into the tags, inserts the citation in the paper, and then when you format, the bibliography is automatically created. And if you delete
the citation, how nice would that have been back in the day?
Think about it. You delete a citation, you reformat, it's gone from the bibliography. You can change from MLA to APA style or to Arabian style. Reformat, it's all regenerated. It changes from bibliography to list of references or whatever. And it's all just basic structured markup, HTML, XML, output HTML, whatever you want to do.
Very cool.
That's the thing
current
is
projects.
The student markup. The student markup. Student market does not have a chasm in front of the mainstream market because most kids are early adopters.
Mm-hmm.
So, to me, that's the way, the stealth way to get structured markup into the mainstream is to start out with kids, students.
Interesting.
And, that when they get used to this approach, if they would have to use Word on the job and start highlighting stuff and applying styles, they're going to say, wait a minute, are you kidding? Why do I have to, do all this stuff? I'm not used to doing this. I'm used to just typing in what I want, push a button, and the formatting is perfect. You know what? they would demand structured markup after having used, Too Cool for School for, all the time they were in, junior high.
Wouldn't that be nice?
On up.
Yeah, wouldn't that be nice? Then we wouldn't have to fight the. But I always did it in FileMaker.
Exactly. It ducks the issue. It sidetracks. It goes. It's a. Goes around the problem. Circumvents the problem. And and also the stuff like the details of the bibliography. Nobody goes to school to learn that. Why should? But you can lose grade points by having a. Comma in the wrong place, or colon, or something. That's stupid. Let the machine do that. Let the computer do that.
Absolutely.
And, the same old thing. Focus on the content, not the format. Of course, if they wanted to fool with the format, they could, but if they didn't want to, you just push the button, and the built-in FOSSI just spits it out.
Exactly. Oh, that would be fabulous.
Wouldn't that be something? So, I think of it's perfect. I think the demand from students would be great. Who wouldn't want something that would do the bibliography for them? So that's where I've been focusing a lot of my energies in the past several years is on my intellectual property, trying to bring structured markup into the mainstream, move beyond WYSIWYG. There's a better way, and I'm trying to think of ways to make that happen faster. I guess because I've experienced all the pain of, you know, trying to process and publish text the old-fashioned way, and knowing that there is a better way without that pain, I want to share that with folks. The world.
Right.
Well, that's
right.
The other thing about the student product.
Me too.
Product. Everybody needs it. It's global. There'll be students while civilization endures. So the market's always there. The niche market.
That's true.
It's a niche market in which everybody needs the product. I don't know how much better it gets than that. So.
Not much. That's true. We've been, I know PTC has been trying to put Pro-E into educational, you know, high school,
mm-hmm.
elementary school, and colleges. And we've been pushing their educational group to put them in universities where there are tech writing programs.
Uh-huh.
Although those are declining in number, especially given the current economy. But
Yeah.
Well,
actually,
it'd be nice.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, I had talked to someone at one point who, well, like I said, a few years back when Norma Hockenstein was still there, one of her clients, I guess, who wanted to get his children's wanted to get some licenses from Norma so that the kids in at school could try this out, because he thought the structured markup was so great. And Scott Youngbloom, another PTC salesman, well, he's with Oberon now,
yeah.
but
yeah.
he said that his daughter came to him and said, why isn't there something, you know, for students? You know, because she knew what he did, she knew what the product does, and she thought there ought to be something for them, not just for office workers, which I should comment, why should students be using a product called Microsoft Office? I don't see that. They deserve their own product. They're not office workers. They have different needs. But anyway, I got off track. What was I talking about?
I don't know. I think we both did, but it's I think it's something that we both are is close to our hearts.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. Definitely. All right. Wow, Suzanne, this has been great. I appreciate your taking so much time to talk to me and give us your background and tell us what your projects you're working on. This has been fabulous.
I should add that I will gladly show pictures of the easy interface to anyone who's non-technical, and I'll show that in person. But any kind of demo to more technical people, we got to have a signed NDA. There's information on my website on that, on the easy interface, and I gave you the website for Too Cool for School. So.
And I will post all that information with the podcast as well.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
Great. And I hope we'll see you next year at the conference.
Well, a good chance. It's in Florida again, right?
Yes, it is.
As long as it's not at Opryland. I was there one year for an Augie, and I will never go back there. Opryland Hotel, or whatever it was called. That was an experience I will never forget.
Well, Augies were all by themselves, but to explain,
there were people that were there to help you find your room because it was difficult to find your rooms in this place. And the guy who was supposed to help find my room could not find my room.
Oh my gosh!
It took like a half an hour to find my room. And then the next day, it took about 30 minutes to walk to the conference venue. So, I hope they never have it there. Anyway, I'd like to think I'll make it next year.
Good, because it's in the same place that we were this year.
Yeah, it was. That was certainly nicer than the Opryland Hotel.
All right, great. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing you next year and your presentation, of course. And looking into your new projects. These are fantastic.
Well,
I'm
glad to get your reaction. You know, I'm working out here on the bleeding edge.
Absolutely.
And,
that's where it's fun.
Well, that's what I guess I think. I guess that's why I stuck with Fosse in the first place and hopefully cracked it before it cracked me. But I guess other people can say whether I'm cracked or not. But it's been a pleasure talking to you, Liz. I'm so glad you called.
Oh, thank you. All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.
The Pub Ride Podcast is a production of Single Sourcing Solutions in San Jose, California. Copyright 2009. Single Sourcing Solutions.